This morning, we have opportunity to interview Harris Frank Beeman about the work of Frank and his wife Patricia at Michigan State on Southern Africa issues. And interviewing him will be myself, David Wiley, director of the African Studies Center and professor of sociology, and Peter Lim of the MSU Library. We want to focus on the Africa issues, but we also want Frank Beeman to tell about his work at MSU and his history here as he became MSU's tennis coach, which actually led to some Southern Africa activity, which he continues to play today in retirement, and his work as director of intramural sports and recreative services at Michigan State. Colleagues have told me that Frank really is one of the founders of democratic sport in intramural sports in the United States. A colleague in New Orleans told me that. But Frank and his wife were known as two of the core members of the efforts at Michigan State to focus on justice and democracy issues in Southern Africa in the 1970s to the 1990s. So, Frank, we would like for you to tell us more about how you became involved in this effort and to recall various developments in the anti-apartheid work at Michigan State. But let's first begin with some personal history. When did you actually come to MSU?
I actually came as a freshman in 1939 and then graduated from Michigan State and went into service and came back and started as an intramural director and tennis coach in 1947. And we really got involved in civil rights partially because of Pat's brother, who was an Episcopal priest who went in Africa and taught in Africa and so forth, and gave us a straight scoop on what was happening there. And so we got involved, figured that that wasn't right, that our country shouldn't be involved that way. And then our actual first encounter was a meeting of SOC over in the East Lansing Library.
All right. Frank, are you a Michiganian? Did you grow up in Michigan?
Yes, I grew up in Royal Oak, Michigan.
In Royal Oak,
which is a suburb of Detroit.
Right.
And
your wife, Patricia, who's sadly no longer with us, was she also from the same area?
Yes. No, she wasn't from that area. She was from Ionia, Michigan.
From Ionia.
Her family moved from New York to Ionia, and then she came to Michigan State, and that's where we met.
Uh-huh. Where were you in the service in World War II?
I was in France and Germany.
In the Army?
I was the athletic officer of the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
I see.
And, in fact, that's where I learned a lot of the things that I used as director of intramurals, because I ran an intramural program, so-called, there.
I see. You seem to have come to MSU with a great deal of concern about racial injustice and the righting of wrongs, of prejudice and discrimination. Did that have an origin in your early years, either in high school or at Michigan State or in the Army?
It must have started from the beginning. My parents were both teachers. My dad was an athletic director in Detroit. My mother taught fourth grade. And somewhere along that line, I was inculcated with the idea of right and wrong. And actually, it was interesting because there were no African Americans in my school district that I went to and so forth. They went down to play Pontiac. It was quite a shock to see black faces and things like that. But it just grew out of somewhere that this is not right.
Uh-huh. So your parents had a strong concern about social rights and wrongs,
right,
and so on.
That's right.
And you must have seen a lot of discrimination in that industrial triangle where so many African Americans and actually Appalachian whites had come up during World War II to work in the defense plants over in the Pontiac,
right,
Saginaw,
and
Detroit area.
It must have been those children that I went to school with and so forth.
Right. Patsy also had a strong concern about that. Were her parents also strongly focused upon issues?
Yes, they were. Her father used to work with the Mexican laborers that came up and worked in the fields up in Ionia, and he spoke Spanish, and so he was kind of a go-between between the farmers and the workers, and so that had an impact, too, on both of us, actually.
Were either of you involved in any of the civil rights activities after World War II in the 50s and 60s?
Well, we got involved with a program called STEP, Student Education Teacher Program, and a group of students and faculty from Michigan State met and went down to Russ College in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And that started because Bob Green had been down through there and been involved in voter rights and so forth.
Bob Green was the former dean of urban affairs at Michigan State and former president of University of District Columbia. And before that, I guess one of Martin Luther King's lieutenants, right?
That's right, yes. Right. And he was on the march while we were down there. We took about a half a dozen students and taught in the school. We integrated the pool that was there. There was two pools, a white pool and a black pool. And we integrated the black pool and taught swimming and things like that. And then the Meredith March occurred during that period of time, and we joined that march at Tuskegee and marched all the way to Jackson. And as we turned a corner in a neighborhood, we saw the Capitol, and the Capitol was ringed by soldiers at standees positioned with their shotguns. And so we marched up to the Capitol, and then Bob Green and other people spoke and so forth. It was quite an adventure.
Right. So when you came back from that adventure with in the South, did that translate into activity here at Michigan State?
Yes, we were involved in a number of demonstrations for voter rights and actually at that time East Lansing had a covenant, and they wouldn't allow any Native American or non-white people to move in. So our daughter and 46 other students sat in front of the police station and blocked the traffic in East Lansing. And
When was this, do you think, approximately?
Oh boy, I'm not good on dates anymore.
But in the early 60s, perhaps.
Right. Bob Green had talked at the union, gave a speech at the union, and then he left for Chicago. But the kids then said to the streets, and they left the union and ran and went to the streets. And Bob was gone, so there was no leadership there. We tried to convince the students that, well, you've made your point now, you can go, because the police said, we'll give you 3 more minutes, and then we'll arrest you. Well, they all wanted to get arrested.
And Bob Green himself had been turned down from buying a house in East Lansing, I believe, when
That's
he moved
right.
here, because he was a person of color, right?
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Was there an organization here at Michigan State or in the community that channeled this concern?
No, there really wasn't at that time, but it was just the beginning. And I'm trying to think what connection that had with Salk later on.
Right. So the Southern Africa Liberation Committee began, I guess, approximately 1972. Is that right? A committee of faculty and students here at Michigan State, and some people from the community as well.
Right. Yes, always Salk was always a combination of students and faculty and community people.
Right. And but how did all that get started? I mean, how did you bridge over from this period of civil rights interest in the 50s and 60s into Salk? I guess there had been many anti-Vietnam War protests here on campus there in the late 60s, 70, 71, 72, right? But then we see the birth of Salk in 72. Do you have memories of how that emerged?
I'm not quite sure. We did hear about the meeting that was being held, and that's the first contact we had with any of the Salk people, yourself and Bell and other people. And it just seemed to be a natural shift from the civil rights to apartheid.
Now, that did you remember who convened that first meeting of the Southern Africa Liberation Committee? Because some of it was related to the United Ministries in Higher Education, I believe, in which Warren Day, Lynn John Dahl, and John Dooley were the pastors at the University Methodist Church, I believe. And then out of that also was emerging the Peace Education Center, right? And so
right.
There was some association of all of that.
Yes, there was. A number of people were in both organizations, Peace Education Center and SAWC. I had thought that you had convened that meeting, as a matter of fact.
I wasn't here at Michigan State yet until 1977. So I think that there other people that I remember were said to be involved were especially William Derman, now professor of anthropology at Michigan State, and Carol Thompson, who is now a professor of political science at Northern Arizona State University, but who at that time was a graduate student in political science here. And I don't know if there are other people that you that come to mind besides yourself.
There were a number of other people. I'm trying to think who they were besides yourself. There was Maggie Etheridge-Vecino, who was a student, and Pat Costa was a student, Mike Bratton, and Ann Schneller also were members.
Right, who also came in 78, right?
Right. Right.
So what led you to go to join with the Southern Africa Liberation Committee, which you and Patricia sort of became the organizational core of SALK? In those days, keeping things moving and going when other people were busy. How did you get yourself to SALK?
Well, I think that partly it was, again, from Pat's brother, Rick Houghton, who was actually in South Africa and in Namibia and kept us informed on how unjust things were.
Now, he was a clergyman in the Episcopal Church
right.
in the United States, right? He was also here in Michigan,
yeah.
But he had then gone to Namibia for the Episcopal mm-hmm. Church, is that right?
Right? Yeah.
Or then, as the South Africans called it, Southwest Africa.
Right.
But then he was asked to leave by the authorities?
He was the last white clergyman out of Namibia
at
that time. And then when he left, there wasn't anybody left there.
This was in the early 1970s.
Right.
That he was, So this led both of you to have sort of a heightened concern about the apartheid.
Well, we knew what government. The information we were getting was straight because it was coming from Rick, and we can believe him. And so we just followed from there.
Right. So what were some of your early activities in SALK in the 70s?
Well, one of the constant things was the leafleting and, in effect, picketing of Wharton Center.
That's what you merged later, right?
Any event that was on, the general rule was if three people would show up, then we would stay there and leaflet and hand out information and so forth. The idea behind SALK, too, was that people would do what was right if they knew the truth, they knew what was actually happening. And so most of the stuff that we put out was informative and educational.
Right. So you emphasized that a great deal in your work with SALK, that you and Patricia, as I remember, in the 70s and 80s, always had a literature table outside of any film or any occasion concerning Southern Africa with materials from the International Defense and Aid Fund in London, from the American right. Committee on Africa in New York, and showed a lot of films.
A lot of films.
Right, and had these very large boards with pictures on them. These were about 4x8 sheets of...
6x8.
Six by eight.
Yes, and we would take the pictures that we got from the IDF and make a story of them. And then at each end of the display were cards addressed to administrators or what was appropriate for people to take and mail. How many of those we got through, I don't know, but they always were out when we would check it out.
You always had postcards, postage paid postcards with people ready to send
the idea opinions. Was to educate people, inform people, and get them to do something.
So Frank, how did you link up with the IDAF and other people for these materials? Did you write to them? How did you network in those days?
I'm trying to think of the Englishman, the man that had that IDF.
Cannon Collins was the coordinator of the International Defense and Aid Fund.
It was someone else. I don't remember his name at this time.
But you had your materials from the American Committee on Africa and the Africa Fund.
Right.
And later from the Washington Office on Africa, I guess.
Right, where you get all information.
Who were channels of these materials?
Also from you. You were our source here.
So, one of the first, let me back up. The Southern African Liberation Committee actually focused, originally, I remember, on some material aid support for some of the refugees and the liberation movements in Southern Africa. And there were Zimbabweans and South Africans who asked, we need to help people with clothing, with dried foods, and so on. So that was, you were involved in those campaigns to raise support.
Yes, we sent books, and later on we also sent tennis rackets and tennis balls.
Mm. I see, kind of your sports connection. Right. Let me take a little diversion just for a second. As I said, I was told by someone in New Orleans, well, you're at that university where the father of democratic sport in America worked, tennis coach, director of intramural sports, Sir Frank Beeman. How did that reputation of yours get established nationally?
Well, it was kind of interesting because generally jocks weren't so much involved in civil rights and things at whatever level, whether they're professional or whether they were college people. And so we kind of stood out because we were straight, and it really came in handy because when I would say it as a coach, people would stop and think about it. At least other coaches wouldn't stop and wonder about what was all this activity. And so that kind of become well known that that we were interested in this sort of thing. And maybe there must be something to this if Beeman is saying it.
I see. That was on the Southern Africa issues. What was your vision about the use of sports on campus?
Well, one of the things that I was involved in was South Africa was working very hard to bring over sports teams so that they were all okay. They're just like everybody else. And so they contacted the universities and the intramural directors and said, can we come and play your rugby team or your volleyball team or your soccer team, and to give them status. And so we sent out 2,500 or so letters to intramural directors throughout the country and at the national meetings, indicating that it was not the thing to do to let South Africa bring teams and play and so forth. And so that became quite a movement in terms of South Africa not being brought up as just a bunch of good guys because they're athletes.
Right. And that emerged into a movement in the United States of sports boycott, I guess, of South Africa.
Right.
As it had in the Commonwealth.
How did that play out here in Lansing and Michigan State then? I mean, this was a time, I remember, Arthur Ashe was prominent, and as you've outlined, the South African government tried to send these rebel teams to break sanctions in different countries. So was the sport issue important here? Did students and faculty and members of the public get interested in this?
I don't know how much they did. I don't know really how much the students were aware, because since we didn't cooperate with South Africa, they were never a presence here. So I don't know what the thing was. But Arthur Ashe and who is the Jamaican singer?
Harry Belafonte.
Belafonte started a sports against apartheid national movement and sent us materials that we could use here also, as well as throughout the country. And in fact, Arthur Ashe refused the invitation to go and play in tournaments there, which became known too.
So, but you were doing that among the intramurals. Did you? Were you the person who started the letters to the intramural directors around the country?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, they originated here, actually.
I see.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's interesting history. One of the first things that Salk focused on in the, after the material support for Southern Africans was the trying to get the East Lansing City Council to do something. And in the late 1970s, 77, 78, do you have some memories of that campaign?
Well, that was the first thing, starting at the grassroots and trying to get the council to pass a selective purchasing agreement, which means that they would not buy cars, for example, because Ford and Chrysler and GM were all involved in that, and so that
they were in South Africa,
right,
producing vehicles for
right.
them.
And so they did pass that selective purchasing agreement. That was the first action. Thought was that you work with your community, you work with the university, you work with the state, you work with the nation, and it was progressive. Each step, bills were passed, and so forth. The thing being that the thought was we should make our community, our university, our state as good as they can be, and they can't be very good if they're involved in supporting apartheid.
So at that time, it was the sort of economic boycott of South Africa and turning off U.S. technology and investment support.
Right.
That was the goal.
Well, and the thing is that people generally, and we didn't in the beginning, realize that, you know, the thought was, well, if GM goes into a country, they're going to help that country because it'll bring jobs and skills and so forth. Not realizing that if you go into South Africa, it doesn't help the people at all. It just helps the white government.
On this question of boycotts and goods, did Salk have any sort of grassroots campaigns against, say, supermarkets or chains that stocked South African goods? I remember in Australia and other countries, there was protests about South African fish and wool and various goods. Did that sort of happen here as well?
It happened in the Coke boycott. You got the students, several student organizations and the dormitories went along with the idea that they shouldn't make Coke available because that just meant more money for apartheid and so forth. And so that was a pretty successful campaign,
mm-hmm.
and the students would go from dorm to dorm, and generally what Pat and I were with them, and they would make speeches and talk about, and again, spreading information
mm-hmm.
about, you know, why we should do this.
And that was something very practical that the students could do, and I guess they switched to Pepsi or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think with Coca-Cola, they had stayed in South Africa. Pepsi had never gotten there. So that made the choice easy. In fact, Pepsi still is having trouble getting into South Africa in the 1990s when they tried to go back with Whitney Houston as their representative. But the Coke was also deeply involved with some of the civil rights and the Martin Luther King family in Atlanta, the Coke headquarters, right?
Right.
So it was a difficult target, and I actually remember that the seniors of Salk, including myself, sort of counseled the students that, do you really want to take on the Coca-Cola behemoth, because it is so large and so powerful and so linked with African-American grants and communities and so on. But you think the students went ahead anyway.
It was interesting because there would be quite a number of students at each of these meetings when the students would make arrangements to come and talk and bring information. And so it made an awful lot of students aware of the whole situation, which they weren't before. You know, how many students were involved with South Africa? Well, this brought it right down to their level.
And I'm sure this whole process was complex and involved a lot of work from you and other colleagues in Salk, this winning people over, the arguing, the presenting of information through your booths and things. And how did this play out then within Salk, where... Did you have branches? Did you have a branch structure? Different groups of Salk, or were there particular questions that were acrimonious, that people, like you mentioned, the involvement of Coke in the African American communities, did some issues stand out as particularly difficult to convince people on?
Well, I don't remember any. We didn't have branches, for example. Everybody, and it was interesting, when you stop and think about it, SOC generally generated at its meetings, weekly meetings that we had, probably 6 to 10 people, really.
6 to 10.
But it became evident that with persistence and constantly bringing this to the fore and getting the state news to cover things and so forth, that the word was going out. And particularly when one of the things that we had was a shanty that we built out in front of the administration building and trying to get the MSU Foundation to divest. And students would come by, and we had stickers that were cut out that had no to apartheid and support Mandela and this kind of thing. And during the weeks of that shanty being up in the wintertime, practically every student had a sticker on his backpack or someplace that would stop by and would hand them out and so forth. And so that became quite widespread. I remember when we actually got the news that McGough was off and the vesture was going forward, and we had after the shanty, we had brought a coffin and put it out in front of the statue, which said protect the people of South Africa and so forth. And I remember the vice president for finance called me up and said, okay, they've done it, I'll get that coffin out of my front yard.
This was a really significant symbolic action then, and one that the students could relate to, that whole popular theatre thing.
The shantytown was built right here on the banks of the Red Cedar, right across from the MSU Computer Center, near Wells Hall. Did you help with the building of the shantytown?
No, that really wasn't tied into the group.
Right. But it was a protest against, because the Michigan State had divested its stockholdings in 1978, but the MSU Foundation had not divested until the mid-80s, so this must have been 85, 86, in that period when the shantytown was built to reflect the crossroads community and the displacement of South Africans of color in the country.
So that was an independent action by the students.
Yeah, right.
That's why I asked earlier about whether there were branches of SELC, because it seems to me that SELC must have had a great impact, as it seems to have been the main or the only anti-apartheid organisation. But here's a case of the students perhaps taking their inspiration from SELC and going ahead. So what, you supported the shanty town?
Yes, we supported it. I don't think that we actually had a table at that particular...
It was in the dead of winter, as I remember.
Yeah.
It was very, very cold.
Yeah.
And the shanties were sometimes being torn down by right-wing students opposed to that protest, right? That was...
What sort of opposition did you get from the right wing? I mean, I presume that, you know, there was heated arguments. And you also mentioned this person, is it Goff?
McGough. I'll come back to Mr. McGough in just a moment.
Okay. So to what extent was the opposition to...
Well, what it was generally would be, a student would come up in one of these tables of information where we would have books and things that we would sell and pass out, and students would come up and argue, you know, and of course I found that the best argument we had was to say, well, do you believe in the Constitution of the United States? Well, of course they did. But if you believe that, then you can't speak out against this sort of thing.
Let's go back to a little bit of the earlier history before we leave it. One of the more significant things that you had a major hand in, Frank, I think, was the decision of the Michigan State University Board of Trustees in 1977 to 77-78. There's a long process there. To sell off Michigan State stockholdings in companies that remain invested in apartheid South Africa. How did that campaign develop?
Well, part of that was that the idea would be that that we would have a representative at every meeting on the campus, whether it was the trustees or whether it was the faculty groups and so forth. We would have a representative there to speak on it, so that it was constantly kept in front of their noses. Actually, I can remember in one of the trustee meetings when one of the trustees said, well, if we used the word slavery, they'd know what we were talking about. And so the as you mentioned before, with Trustee Radcliffe and Trustee Martin and so forth, we had a lot of support there. And there was nothing that was held on campus that we didn't have a representative at, whatever it was. So it was constantly in front of them. And I'm sure it must have had some effect on some of their individual activities.
Now, the student organizations make some inputs on that, right? The
ASMSU
and the Council of Graduate Students, COGS, they both... And then it was referred to a faculty committee on the faculty committee
right.
on academic environment.
That's right.
As to what to make a recommendation.
Right, and they met, and it just took about a year's time, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And
to review it.
When they brought the one interesting thing that we had prepared a green book folder with a lot of information, must have been 20 pages. And when the trustees were having one meeting, we went ahead and got there early and put one at each of their places. And so they thought that that was part of the official documents that they were supposed to talk about that day.
Right. But the two of the key movers on the MSU Board of Trustees then were Aubrey Radcliffe, a Republican, and also an African-American teacher in the Lansing area. And Blanche Martin, who is a Democratic representative, an elected representative, also African-American. Did you feel you had strong support from them in this effort?
Oh, yes, we did have very, very good, very verbal commitments and so forth.
And Radcliffe actually made the motion for MSU divestiture
in
the board.
Did. Yes, it was Radcliffe. That's right.
Right. And... I guess he later says he paid a political price for doing
yes,
that.
Yes, he
right?
felt that because he didn't get reelected the next time around.
And he felt the party was not supportive of his having done that. So were you surprised when MSU took that action?
Well, yes, I guess I was, or we were. Although, of course, we felt that they could not when they had the information, if they believed it, you know. On what actually the support was when the company was in South Africa.
What about the MSU administration? Did you have their support in that? With your president was Clinton Horton at that time?
Yes, because also then when President DiBiagio, in fact, one of the pamphlets we have shows a picture of him on Apartheid Day getting a armband by the president, W. Miller, who was president of SAUK at that time. And so that, and he also came out and looked at the shanty and talked with the students at the time. So
right. I've heard a rumor, Frank, that you used your tennis coach position to lobby the MSU presidents on their position on these Southern Africa issues. Is that true?
Well, generally, yes. There wasn't any pitch discussion, but they knew how I felt, and they knew, and occasionally, because both of them were tennis players, and I would be playing with them and discussing kind of things. So
this was Clifton Horton as well?
No, that was with John DiBiagio.
John DiBiagio, yeah. And then Cecil Mackey as well, perhaps?
No, he was after that. I was trying to think the... where the connection was that played with us. It was Stan Drovac, who was then the tennis coach who had followed me, and I can't bring to mind the other person that was involved at that time.
But then, so MSU does pass and becomes the bill in the Board of Trustees and becomes the first university divest of the stocks in the nation, and that becomes a significant movement then later in the 70s and 80s across the nation as others follow suit.
Well, you know, what was interesting is we could make the point very well from newspaper clippings and other information that one of the arguments that the opponents used was, well, it'll cost us money if we change and we restrict our portfolio, it's going to cost university money. Turns out that the university made more money on their investments after they divested.
Right. I believe that their Ann Arbor investment firm had been heavily invested in large capital stock holdings, and by switching, they at the time happened to invest in small cap stocks, and their value went up on the stock exchange. So, as you say, it did not cost MSU anything. Were you in touch at all with the efforts at University of Michigan and Ann Arbor in this direction?
Well, yes. Having graduated both from Michigan State and Michigan, I felt that I had a vested interest, and so I spoke at one of their trustee meetings that they had when they were considering it. And, you know, University of Michigan was fighting it all the way, saying that they were independent, autonomous, they didn't have to do what the state did, and so forth. And so I did speak to the trustees and handed them information also.
The state of Michigan then got involved, and I guess the first bill was the so-called banking bill in 1979, which was a bill to say that the surplus funds of the state of Michigan, ironic in these hard pinch times, which were the current accounts funds that were held in banks, could not be used for in banks, could not be deposited in banks that were making loans to South Africa or people who were investing in South Africa. And were you involved in the run-up to that decision in the state legislature?
Yes, again, we met with Perry Bullard. We met with who's a native, American native, Scott, Virgil Smith,
who later became senator and at that time a representative from
so
Detroit.
So we had met with them. In fact, one time we had a meeting with the Ford Motor Company lawyers in Bullard's office, and they were trying to defend their position and so forth for staying there. But
yes, there are a number of official hearings, and I believe you had your literature and your information tables.
Right. We got permission to put the tables up in the Capitol building when they're having those things. So the Senator had to go by it to get in and out. So that helped, I think.
And you even showed films for the representatives, the senators, and their staff.
That's right, yes.
Do you remember what films were especially important at
that
time?
Well, one was Last Grave at Dimbaza, which we used a lot of places. In fact, I used it in one of my classes, stretching a little bit the core material. We would have, as one of our activities, we had every other Friday night, and I'm just showing you that these were the advertisements for the film
poster
we had.
Right. Yeah. Friday night horror movies, you call
right.
them, on South Africa.
Right.
And got pretty good turnouts at those movies campus.
Yeah, and again, we would have cards there to senators and to congressmen and officials that people could send.
Right. So the banking bill gets passed, and then a year or two later, the state legislature passes the higher education sanctions bill, right? That requires all of Michigan's state colleges and universities, some 35 or so, to follow Michigan State suit and divest of stock holdings and so on. Did you have much interaction with the other campuses in regard to that bill?
Yes, we did. In fact, we had the bills that we had generated through you and other Africanists, we would send throughout the country, as a matter of fact. Northern Michigan, I remember, California schools who had groups and wanted information, we would send them on a packet.
And so lots of information. And then finally, the You have in the mid-80s the MSU Foundation divestiture, and that was successful in the end after the
right.
after the Shanty campaign and the Salk information efforts there. And then all that leads, I guess, in many ways to 1986. We get both the state of Michigan banking bill
right.
divestiture, which is, I think, some $3 or $4 billion of state pension fund divestiture of stocks, a commitment to do that. And at the same time, the MSU Foundation decides
right.
to divest as well, to follow the Michigan State University Board of Trustees policy. Is that correct? All during this, go ahead.
Is that the pension fund?
Pension fund is 1986, I think, the same year as the, in Washington, the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986,
right.
which the Congressional Black Caucus, an organization started by Michigan's Charles Diggs of Detroit, and continued in 1980 by Representative Howard Wolpe, PhD African Studies, representing Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, and later Lansing. Together, those worked toward the national action, Anti-Apartheid Act of 86, which then actually overcomes the President Reagan's veto of that. So that 80s period was a period of great ferment and great activity
yes.
for you and Salk. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yes. The I guess one of the more colorful campaigns at Michigan State was in the middle of all that was in the 1984 so-called McGough off campaign. Can you share with us who Mr. McGough was and what the genesis of that campaign
well,
was?
Mr. McGough at that time owned about half a dozen or so newspapers and so forth. And
here in Michigan, right.
Right. And it became known that he would instruct his editors not to print anti-apartheid information and only have information supposedly supporting it. And the crux came when he appeared before the South African Parliament and made some statements saying that it was a great institution and it's a great country and supporting South Africa and so forth. And so what brought to a head was then he and his wife donated $100,000 to the Wharton Center for the small stage that was there. There was two stages, a large stage and a small
stage. Festival.
Yeah,
what is that called? The festival stage.
Right.
Right.
And then one time when they were having a program and we were outside picketing, Mrs. Goff came out to discuss things with us and said, well, and there was a WINS, I think it was, a reporter there with a camera. And she's saying, well, you know, those people are not like our people. They enjoyed living as they are living. Well, these statements made a great
referring to South Africans.
Referring to South Africa. Right.
South Africans of color were enjoying their apartheid
right.
situation.
And so, and then in the middle of that, her husband came out and took her by the arm and brought her back into the auditorium. So it was Wharton then, Vice President Wharton, who was then in Washington, I believe, wrote a column, two column article on the fact that we should get out of South Africa. And that kind of clinched the whole thing there as far as the Goffs were concerned. So
yes, he had left MSU to become the chancellor of the New York State system, the SUNY system, and then became the head of Tia Kreft, the retirement company for many faculty members. And he made that statement then, which helped him to move that along. Mr. McGough, I guess, was also involved with South Africans in trying to seek a presence for South Africans in a newspaper in the United States as well.
Well, yes, and the other thing that got involved is he was being investigated by South Africa because some $4 million had gone astray somewhere along the line. They couldn't account for it. And so he was
this
under
is a
pressure.
Scandal, is it?
Yes, Muldergate, right. and
which then led the South African government to publish a white paper which told the whole story,
right,
of how the money had been passed to Mr. McGough to purchase a newspaper. I think they in the end bought a newspaper in Sacramento, California, in Reagan's hometown, and there it was. That cost less than the $10 million that had been passed to him to do this. They wanted the Washington Star, which today is the Washington Times, as a pro-apartheid voice in Washington in the policy debate. Well, during that period as well, I mean, the South Africans were making very large efforts to influence Americans on policy. Did you see evidence of them here in Michigan?
That was one of the efforts of their sports thing that they tried to do. They tried to send over teams of various sports and so forth to play on the campuses. And that was one of the efforts that they made.
Right. I think someone estimated that they may have been spending in the heyday of the 80s, when the tipping point had not yet been reached in the decision to release Mandela. The U.S. Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act had not been passed, and so on. That there was a feeling that the U.S. might still be won over, and so they may have been spending as much as $1 million a year just on Michigan for trips of legislators and newspaper editors and influentials in the companies and so on, in order to influence Michigan policy, even with information kits out in the schools, right, on the happy Bantu.
That's right. And posters, yes, right. Posters right. Supporting that kind of thing.
So did you ever have encounters with any of the South African visitors here in that period?
No, we never did. One, because we didn't let them come on campus from the sports end, and I don't know from the other, but I remember calling the State Journal reporter who was covering the McGough situation, and she said, "Well, I shouldn't say this, but that the trustees are going to have the McGough name removed from the festival stage." And so then I called one of the trustees and talked with them, and they said, "Well, it was a very hard decision, but we gave them their money back."
So that was a long-term victory for the Southern Africa Liberation Committee.
And the next day, if you notice, if you've ever been in the auditorium, by the festival stage, there's an aluminum plaque, and it had originally had Miss McGough's name on it. The next day, that plaque was removed.
So what happened with all this now? The McGough off campaign wins, Michigan State is divested, the state of Michigan passes more bills, three bills than any other state legislature. The nation passes the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986, and we're only just a few years from Mandela then being released and culminating in the 1994 elections that brought democracy to South Africa. What was happening with Salk and all this? Was its reason for existing being taken away by the collapse of apartheid?
Yes, it was sort of gone, and actually at that time too. Then I had been the faculty advisor for Salk at that point, and of course my wife Pat from the community was kind of the leader, and we just simply didn't have to do the things that we'd been doing for several years, movies and meetings and so forth.
So there was a kind of a gradual tailing down then of the information activity.
Yes, Salk had always been on the umbrella of the Peace Education Center, and they were able to supply materials and things like that and put posters out. And so then generally that activity then did go to the Peace Education Center for there was anything going on there.
Right. And you also made an effort then to see that the records of Salk and so on were deposited with the MSU Special Collections and their American Radicalism section, so one can find all the records there, right?
That's right. It was very, very nice of them to do that, because all of the materials and things had been stored in my garage, which people didn't get to see very often.
and that collection is now being fully catalogued, and we've had the pleasure on a number of occasions to show it to visiting South Africans, including Andre Odendaal from the Mayabuye Centre, and they've been delighted to see such a treasure house of anti-apartheid materials. I'm wondering, Frank, that with your interest in sport and tennis and given the changes in South Africa and liberation in 94, what do you have any views and experiences on sport in the new South Africa?
Well, I was very fortunate that they were held, and I forget the year now, they held the international tennis championships in South Africa. And so I thought, well, this is a good excuse and an opportunity for me. So I went there and played in that tournament and also visited with one of the graduate students, Kate Segete, who we had helped with tuition and things like that here at Michigan State, and stayed with him and toured a great deal of South Africa. It was very interesting. There was really only one non-white player in that tournament, Nehemiah Johnson, who was a Native American native from the South, who was a very good player, and he was in the tournament. So I had a chance to meet a lot of international players and also to visit places in South Africa.
What was your feeling about South Africa, having worked on it for 20 or 30 years, and suddenly you're seeing it in the post-Mandela period? What were your impressions of that?
Well, it was interesting. Conditions weren't a lot different, I don't think, as far as people's daily lives. At every corner that you went by, practically in the country, there was somebody on a corner selling fruit or so forth and to make a little money. And one thing that bothered me a little bit was in the hotel that we stayed at. In the lobby, there were always several young black men, basically, who would greet you very much, oh, yes, sir, no, sir, this kind of thing that bothered me a little bit. They were all dressed in suits and things like that, but it still put it on the basis of the old master kind of thing. That was a noticeable thing.
And earlier on, if we can go back just for a minute, you mentioned Ford and the auto industry. And I'm just wondering how Salk managed to perhaps work with the labor unions, and what sort of involvement there was from the other side of Lansing. Mm-hmm. If we go away from East Lansing for a while, of course, it's the center of the auto industry. So did the anti-apartheid movement manage to link up with labor unions? Because this was also a big issue in the 70s and 80s, was the super exploitation of black labor in South Africa.
Yes, the unions that were involved all supported the activity. I can't think of any specific instance, but the unions were definitely in favor of non-apartheid activity. I remember the time we met with the Ford lawyers in Perry Bullard's office, and they were quite surprised that the information we had pointed out how Ford's activities in South Africa aided South Africa and not South Africans, which was the difference there.
I believe Salk was involved as well with the United Mine Workers in their campaign out of Ohio. I believe their headquarters was in Cleveland for a boycott of Shell because of its presence in Shell Oil Company, its presence in South Africa, and especially its work in the homelands of the Transkei, especially was one of their, I think there was a support of that mine workers boycott, right? That was. And there was a boycott Shell service stations effort that Salk supported in as well as a part of the union campaign. I think there also were a few people from Salk made presentations to the United Auto Workers at their headquarters in Detroit as well to try to bring them on the side of of the sanctions as well.
I do think that the actions of SOC basically did educate and inform an awful lot of people during that period of time mm-hmm. about South Africa and the connections and why it wasn't good to be there.
What sort of coverage did you get in all your activities from the media? You mentioned the state news earlier. What about television media and radio? Did they come and cover your protests, and did you manage to get on some SOC members get on TV and radio?
Well, this one is, as I mentioned earlier, out in front of the Warden Center, was covered by the television people, and also the shanty that we had bid out in front of the administration building, that was covered. The media supported the activities, as I recall, and editorials and discussions.
What about marches and rallies? Did you have any anti-apartheid marches?
Oh, yes, we had a number of them. So many I can't remember.
One of the key ones, I think, was when Salk joined in the Hands Around the Capitol demonstration.
Exactly.
Downtown, when the Michigan Capitol building was completely surrounded by people wanting the passage of the pension divestiture bill of 1985-86, right, and with which Salk and others appealed to the Trans-Africa chapter in Detroit and to come up and support it. And I remember there were several busloads of people from the Church of the Black Madonna mm-hmm. in Detroit that came and joined Salk right. and others in this.
Yeah,
and it completely surrounded the Capitol.
Completely surrounded. There was no spot where there wasn't somebody holding hands or somebody on either side all the way around.
Right. The untold story is that in my garage today, my tomato ties to tie up my tomato plants are the 2-foot-long strips of cloth that were held in reserve in case we didn't have enough people to surround the Capitol that we could hold on to.
Must have been a great moment. What about South Africans themselves? Were there black South Africans or other South Africans here in Michigan who got involved, maybe at a later stage or even earlier? Or for that matter, African students at MSU?
Well, I can remember some. On both sides, I can remember some South Africans coming up and saying, well, this is all propaganda and it wasn't like that and so forth. And on the other side, we would have South African students who would applaud us and support us. So there were both sides of it. Again, the best argument we had was the Constitution, which, of course, you couldn't use in South Africa because their Constitution specifically said the whites were better than blacks. And
and I believe Salk sponsored some South African and Zimbabwean and Namibian speakers, right, to come to talk about the situation from the African National Congress and the Pan-Africanist Congress and
SWAPO.
And SWAPO.
It's interesting the Namibian angle, because earlier you mentioned that your direct sort of source initially was Rick, who'd been a clergyman in Namibia. And did anything specific develop around Namibia? I presume on your information stalls you had stuff on from SWAPO or the UN on Namibia. Did that? Were there any interesting developments in that regard?
No, I was trying to think of the connection and with SWAPO and the other organizations, but I can't think of anything that occurred after that, or specifically, actually, Rick, I remember now, was at Odibo, St. Mary's Church in Odibo, that he was the last white bishop or last white clergyman out of there.
I think it's fair to say that Salk's heavy focus was initially on Zimbabwe, right, and so there was support of the Rhodesian Chrome sanctions in the Congress, and there were a lot of visitors from ZANU and ZAPU. That came to speak to campus, and because there were a number of Zimbabweans here and people who had worked in southern Rhodesia, as it was called, before. So there was kind of a focus, first of all, on Zimbabwe, but then mostly on South Africa. Is that
right?
Is that fair?
Mm-hmm. I think so. In fact, originally in 72, when SAWK got started, they were concerned with all the African countries over there, not just South Africa or Namibia.
Did you ever have an office, or was SAWK sort of run out of your respective homes?
Yeah, and then David Wiley's office. No, we never did have an office place. We had our house, basically, where materials came from.
A lot of the SAWK materials were in the Peace Education Center library on the reference materials, right?
Right.
But as I remember, your car was always full of
posters
and photo displays and so on.
I'm also wondering whether SAWK sort of linked up with other solidarity organizations, such as amongst African Americans or Native Americans or anti-war groups. Was there any involvement in this broader movement of solidarity?
No, there was.
And including from those organizations back to you, which is always an interesting one to think about.
I can't think of any specific group that we worked with, although we were open to any group that was interested in activity.
I think it's fair to say that SAWK in many ways drew on the information and the campaigns of the American Committee on Africa in New York and the Africa Fund's information. And then later, in the 1970s, from the Washington Office on Africa and the Washington Office on Africa Education. Yeah. I think those were the two national
And
Bill Johnson, the Episcopal Churchman for, I guess later, Episcopal Church people of Southern Africa, was it? And was really focused on Namibia, right?
Yeah.
Because of the Episcopal Church's connection there. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think there were also some local campaigns. Like, I remember SAWK asking the Crop Walk, which is a Church World Service fundraising thing, to first of all focus its campaigns on the needs of people in Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, and to dedicate the funds that were raised by all these hundreds of church people across across Michigan that marched to raise funds for the needs of the third world people. So there, SAWK was involved in that, in trying to get the Black Pastors Group in Lansing to participate in that and that solidarity. But I think the main organizational creation, if I remember, Frank, from SAWK years, was with the Trans-Africa chapter in Detroit, with Akua Budu and Margaret Baylor, who were co-chairs of that chapter of Trans-Africa out of Washington. But I think there were too many other links, organizational
and
links.
And who was in Washington, who was Frank somebody, can't remember, he came and made some talks.
Is Ted Lockwood as the director of the Washington Office on Africa? Or Randall Robinson was the head of Trans-Africa. He made a couple of visits there, right, in addition to others. But in some ways, SAWK was fairly self-contained, focused on the Michigan issues, the Michigan State issues, and really homing in here. And I think probably SAWK not understanding fully how unique this mobilization in Michigan was and compared with the other states around the country.
So just to clarify then, was SAWK structurally or organizationally, was an MSU body, or was it an East Lansing body? It was public body?
It involved students and faculty and community people.
So it was beyond the campus.
But it was registered as a student organization, I believe, at one time, so that it could show its films and use university facilities.
And one time they received an award. I can't remember now where it was. I can remember getting the award, a plaque, for being an outstanding student group.
I see.
Okay.
Frank, did you get much resistance from your colleagues, either in the sports arena or more generally in MSU, that, oh, here comes this demon who's got this thing about South Africa?
The I guess we can say this. The main opposition I got at that time was, the Interim Department was under the Athletic Department rather than the Student Affairs Department. And I had requested a 6-month leave, which I was entitled to go work down in Mississippi on voter registration and so forth. And I can remember talking with Biggie Munn. He had one of these phones that you talked to, and anybody in the room could hear it. And he said, "I didn't know you were interested in that color. You're going down there. I thought you were more a what is the phrase he used? Sort of mid color and so forth." So there was a little.
Biggie Munn was the
athletic director.
Athletic director at Michigan State,
I guess. And
this was in the what period? In the
That would 1960s. Be when that was during the Meredith March, the summer of the Meredith March, and we went down there for. And so, whereas he couldn't stop me from going, he certainly didn't encourage me in that activity.
Mm-hmm. And then when you were showing all these films and doing all this information, no one was questioning your...
Yeah, very, very rarely was there anybody that really argued about this is wrong or this is right and so forth. Did have he wasn't a student, it was from the Lansing area, who was a South African, who would say, "Well, this is propaganda that you're handing out." And he said, "Well, it's probably, it may be so, but it's true, whatever it is." So that was what made the arguments easy, because it was true. It was so wrong, you know, to have enslaved a whole nation of people under the rules they were, that, how do you argue for it? And so that helped a little bit.
So as you look back over all this activity, all these thousands of hours that you invested in,
I cannot imagine how we did it. Absolutely cannot. But you stop and think that every other week you had to come up with another poster and design it and make it and get it to the printer and this kind of thing. That was a constant of our life.
Did that give you some satisfactions in looking back at it? And
very much so. In fact, I think the biggest part we had was the day that they took the McGough name off the thing as a specific thing. That was such a relief. You didn't think it would ever happen. You know, the university would give back $100,000.
So that was the high point for you.
Right.
And then when you went back to South Africa and actually could see this mm-hmm. you realized that there were real results of this campaign and this struggle, and that you were at the core of Michigan State, which in many ways was the precipitant of the national higher education anti-apartheid effort.
Part in it. Yes, it was certainly
that made a contribution to this.
Yes,
right. Several South Africans have come to campus to recognize you and others in Salk for the contribution that was made in their struggle, and Ahmed Kathrada, who had been in Robben Island for those many years, and others. And I tell you, that has been a source of pleasure and satisfaction to you to know that that's possible.
It was interesting because I got a chance to visit Robben Island when I was there at the tennis tournament, and all of the men, I believe it was just men, who worked there had been there in prison, and now it's turned around and they were running the thing as a tourist event kind of thing. Interesting.
So that was must have been an emotional moment to step onto Robben Island and here
was
Mandela and all those Sisulu and all those folks
to see the cells and so forth, almost two by four cells that they lived in.
Moving on. So out of all this, do you have advice to Michigan State faculty and students about how they think about such issues in the future of this university?
I think they should not limit themselves. They should be open, again, to education and information. And I think to do something that that is good for, again, your community, your university, your state, and your nation, to try and make them as best as they can be, and that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Harris Frank Beeman, thank you very much for sharing this very significant history in Michigan State, which you were at the core of. And congratulations on having been so historically wise as to have chosen a good struggle.
Well, I had a good mentor in my wife. So she was a great...
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome.